Alaskans don't believe in discrimination of any kind, and you shouldn't discriminate in the workplace.
Alaska senators vote for a bill banning discrimination against gays. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, bad weather hampers efforts to salvage a grounded vessel near Unalaska.
The bottom gets split open, the engines and gears fall out of the bottom, and it gets pretty ugly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Gay rights advocates are celebrating a win today in the nation's capital. The U.S. Senate has passed a bill to ban workplace discrimination against gay and transgender people. Both Alaska senators voted for it, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports from Washington, the bill is unlikely to become law.
In the end, it wasn't even close, 64 to 32. Senator Mark Begich says the relative lack of controversy is a mark of how far the country has come on gay rights in recent years, and he thinks Alaska is no exception.
I think Alaskans don't believe in discrimination of any kind, and you shouldn't discriminate in the workplace.
Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of 10 Republicans who joined Democrats in voting in favor of the non-discrimination bill, known by its acronym ENDA. Current federal law already bans employers from firing or refusing to hire based on race, sex, or ethnicity. But in Alaska and 28 other states, no law expressly bans discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Murkowski said on the Senate floor the existing categories leave some people out.
Those in the LGBT community for whom discrimination on the basis of sex does not apply. So what ENDA does is it bridges that gap. And it is time that that gap is resolved.
It has an exception for churches and religious schools. Still, it's unlikely to pass the House or even come to the floor. House Speaker John Boehner opposes it. He says it would lead to frivolous lawsuits. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Shell Oil is taking measures to revive its troubled Arctic drilling program. Yesterday, the company filed an updated Arctic exploration plan with the Alaska Office of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. John Callahan, a public affairs officer for BOEM, says even though it's based off the exploration plan Shell used in 2012, it's a lot shorter.
And what Shell submitted just focuses on the changed parts.
This time, Shell left their Beaufort Sea leases out of the plan because the specialized Kulik rig the company used for that region is still out of commission from when it ran aground in the Gulf of Alaska on New Year's Eve 2012. Callahan says the exploration plan will go through the same review process that BOEM used last time.
The first thing that happens is we have our folks look over it and determine whether all the required components are there in order to launch a more thorough review.
Shell isn't taking questions from reporters about their drilling plans, but they put out a short statement this week saying, quote, "We will continue to take a methodical approach to this exploration phase and will only proceed if the program meets the conditions necessary to proceed safely and responsibly," end quote. But that's not enough to satisfy environmentalists. The Ocean Conservancy is calling the 2014 exploration plan premature and accusing the company of rushing back to the Arctic. The Alaska Supreme Court is standing behind a decision it issued last spring, affirming that the state must consider cumulative impacts of exploration and development as it reviews oil and gas leases. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, opposing sides in the case have differing views on the significance of the decision.
The High Court rejected the state's request to reconsider its March ruling in the suit filed by Alaska Native and environmental groups. Northern Alaska Environmental Center Arctic Program Director Pam Miller says the court's decision on oil and gas development impacts is backed by guarantees in the Alaska Constitution.
the Alaska Supreme Court made it clear that there's a constitutional requirement to consider the cumulative impacts of projects, not just at the leasing phase where there's a lot we don't know about what may happen in the future.
The environmental group's suit followed a 2010 state-issued best interest finding for a 10-year oil and gas lease sale for a massive area of the Beaufort Sea, a review plaintiffs say the state failed to adequately follow up on. DNR Division of Oil and Gas Legislative and Policy Advisor Bob Pawlowski says the agency is always looking to improve its review process, but the current one is adequate to address the court's ruling.
We do a best interest finding, and annually we ask for new information to that best interest finding from the public so that when the issues of concerns for cumulative effects or cumulative impacts come up, the public has the ability to tell us, well, we see this coming. Could you address it in your annual review of the best interest finding?
Pawlowski emphasizes that there's a difference between useful information and opinions.
The difference is this is information that we can use to better our best interest finding and keep our best interest finding current. A public comment may be, well, we disagree with leasing.
Pawlowski says the state's primary reason for requesting reconsideration of the ruling was its potential impact on the state legislature. The Northern Center's Miller says the ruling should force reexamination of a legislative push to speed up development.
What this means is that current efforts with bills like House Bill 77 and other, quote, streamlining efforts to silence the public voice throughout consideration of projects needs a hard look.
The Supreme Court's refusal to reconsider its decision requiring consideration of cumulative lease impacts throughout the exploration and development process was welcomed this week by plaintiffs, including the Gwich'in Steering Committee, which noted the requirement to consider future impacts to fish, wildlife, and subsistence. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a pop-up museum in Anchorage's Fairview neighborhood.
The idea is to create more accurate public memory and public history of what's happening in that neighborhood and what can happen in that neighborhood.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Since 1978, the Older Persons Action Group has been the publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families. They now offer a digital version online at SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
After serving as acting revenue commissioner for the past 3 months, Angela Rodell now officially has the job. The department collects taxes and handles the investment of those funds, but most Alaskans know the commissioner for announcing the permanent fund dividend amount. Rodell joined the department 2 years ago and has served as state treasurer and as deputy commissioner. She replaces Brian Butcher, who left the position to head the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Rough weather is taking a toll on the grounded fishing vessel Arctic Hunter, which has been stuck on the rocks outside Unalaska since last Friday. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
The 93-foot crab boat has survived a series of storms this week without breaking apart, but salvagers haven't been able to work on the vessel since last weekend. Dan McGowan of Resolve McGowan Marine Services is in charge of recovery efforts.
We've got seas building out there that are expected to stay big onshore swells until sometime next week, so we're not too sure when we're going to get back out there.
Meanwhile, McGowan says debris like toolboxes and a survival suit from the Arctic Hunter is starting to wash up on the beach. He says he expects the vessel's condition to keep deteriorating in the bad weather before salvagers can return.
It basically just beats them apart, you know. The bottom gets split open. Sometimes the propeller shafts get pulled out through the back and the engines and gears fall out of the bottom and, you know, it gets pretty ugly.
Before the weather turned, McGowan says his crews pumped out about 9,000 gallons of fuel water mix from the Arctic Hunter. More than half of that was fuel. McGowan says there could still be fuel in some tanks below the waterline, but there's nothing they can do about that until weather calms down. While they wait, McGowan says they're getting ready for the final push.
Right now, what we're doing is gear up for the wreck removal phase of the project. And so we're busy getting our small barge set up so that we can use it to support the diving and the other work that we need to do in the shallow waters there.
At this stage, all the Coast Guard can do to help is monitor the seas for an oil sheen. Coast Guard Public Affairs Officer Sean Eggert says once the vessel's off the rocks, the Coast Guard will start digging into what caused the accident.
The investigation can take anywhere from a month to a year. You know, in this case, I don't expect it will take that long, but I haven't gotten any kind of a estimate on how long they expect it'll take.
So far, the Coast Guard has said the skipper of the vessel might have been asleep at the wheel, and Unalaska's police department says the skipper failed a breathalyzer test a few hours after the grounding. Eggert couldn't say if or when charges might be filed. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
It's been almost 3 years since a tsunami hit the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan, leading to releases of contaminated water into the ocean, and leaks from the plant are still not fully contained. Computer models indicate only minuscule amounts of contamination will reach Alaskan waters this year or next. But one expert says comprehensive sampling is needed to check radiation levels. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Douglas Dasher is a scientist with 30 years' experience researching radiation in Alaskan waters from nuclear tests. He says there are plenty of computer models that show contaminated waters from Fukushima will mix with clean Pacific Ocean waters and be at safe levels, but he says he can't show hunters or fishermen hard data backing that up.
And that's where we really come up short, is we can't give them assurances that, yeah, we are actually sampling, or can we point them towards anyone that's actively sampling, say, subsistence foods or, the wildlife. The U.S. Federal Drug Group, FDA administration, they are sampling commercial foods that come into the United States.
Dasher says he's working with the North Slope Borough to test wildlife in Arctic waters, and researchers out on the ocean on other projects are taking samples, but he says a much larger set of samples of the water and from salmon and marine mammals, for instance, is needed to prove the computer models correct or incorrect. He says that level of research depends on federal funding, and that hasn't been there.
That is it's a concern a lot that's been expressed, and the Pacific, some of the research groups have been expressing that too, and the frustration with that. And so the people, the subsistence hunters or others that you talk to, are the same thing. They want to see actual numbers. They want to see some concrete data. You may disagree on the health levels and effects, but at least you can have concrete data out there. They ask the same question, and there's no real answer to that right now.
By email, a spokesman for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration stated NOAA is not actively involved in monitoring radiation related to Fukushima. EPA didn't respond in time for this broadcast, but on its website states it continuously monitors the nation's air and periodically tests precipitation, drinking water, and milk for radiation. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaskans took their health care questions to health insurance marketplace experts at a forum in Juneau on Monday. KTOO's Lisa Fu was there and compiled audience questions and answers into this story.
What is the difference between a healthcare navigator and a healthcare broker?
As a navigator, we are really just sort of there to help people navigate healthcare.gov. Brokers can really help people to give them specific direction and suggestions on what plans might best fit their situation. Versus a navigator, we're there to just kind of help them through the process and couldn't direct them to a plan that might best fit their needs.
Will I get the same information about healthcare plans from a navigator and a broker?
Yes, brokers and navigators, we both are able to help people on the marketplace. A broker might have more options outside of the marketplace. For instance, I believe Aetna is one that's really offering a lot of plans, but they don't offer plans on the marketplace. So a broker would be able to give you more options, whereas a navigator just helps you on those plans that are available at healthcare.gov.
When will the healthcare.gov website start working?
Currently, the federal government has stated that by November 30th, they expect to have the website up and functioning. Once we are confident in the subsidy calculation and the functionality of the marketplace, we will deploy in full force to get individuals enrolled.
Since the website isn't working properly, I keep hearing that I can enroll by phone or mail. Is this true?
The bottom line is no. The website, healthcare.gov, is the one location where individuals can enroll into the federally facilitated marketplace. If the website is not functioning, individuals cannot enroll over the phone.
What's the difference between enrolling for an insurance plan through healthcare.gov and enrolling straight from a provider?
If you qualify for a government subsidy, the only way to enroll into a health insurance policy and have that subsidy apply to your premium is through healthcare.gov. If you do not qualify for a government subsidy, you can go direct to a carrier.
How do I qualify for government subsidy?
You qualify for a subsidy really based on your household income. So for household income, we use the federal poverty guidelines. 100 to 400% of the federal poverty line in this state, if you're somewhere in between that, then most likely you're going to qualify for financial assistance, aka a subsidy, to help you pay for your health coverage.
What is Alaska's federal poverty line?
For an individual, it would be $14,350 all the way up to around $57,000. So 100% of the federal poverty line in Alaska is that $14,350, and then four times that is at that $57,000. So if you're an individual and you are somewhere in between that income level, then most likely you're going to get financial assistance in the marketplace, and you should definitely pursue that.
If I'm Alaska Native and I use the tribal health options that are available to me in my community, do I have to enroll in a new health plan?
No. If you go to a tribal health facility, you can keep going there just like you've been doing. That stays the same. But you do need to sign up for that exemption called the Indian Status Exemption so that you aren't subject to a tax penalty at the end of the year.
Do military have to apply for an exemption like Alaska Natives do?
No, if you get benefits, VA benefits, or any sort of veterans benefits, then you don't need to prove or apply for an exemption. And then in addition, if you're on government programs like Medicaid or you have Medicare, then you don't need to apply for an exemption. You're considered someone who has health insurance.
And finally, I keep hearing about bronze, silver, and gold packages. What are they?
All plans have to offer what are called 10 essential health benefits. So if they're really offering the same coverage, they're going to differ in this metallic rating of bronze, silver, gold. If you have a bronze plan, you're probably paying less per month, but maybe more in your out-of-pocket expenses when you go to the doctor for your copays or deductibles. Compared to someone who has a gold plan, they're probably paying more per month for their premium, but then when they go to the doctor, they might have a smaller copay or deductible as part of that plan.
In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Questions were answered by Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Navigator Monique Martin, United Way Navigator Crystal Borland, and Chief Operating Officer for Enroll Alaska, Tyann Bowling.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
The cost of prep work on a new power plant that Municipal Light and Power is building is now double what it was budgeted for. The Anchorage Assembly grilled the power company's manager about the increased cost at the Assembly's Tuesday meeting. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The project, which is part of an overhaul of the city's power system, was originally supposed to cost around $5 million. It's now slated to cost nearly $11 million. Assemblymember Amy Demboski gave this overview of the situation to Assemblymember Paul Honeman.
Essentially, MLMP had a contract to do dirt work on a site that's the precursor to a power plant. The initial contract was about $5.2 million. And 6 weeks into the project, Mr. Honeman, the contractor notified MLMP that there was going to be at least a $3 million overrun. MLMP knew that and did not tell the assembly.
A memo from Mayor Dan Sullivan, dated November 5th, asks the Assembly for the additional funds. The contractor is Roger Hickel Contracting. The job was to prepare about 5 acres of land in the Muldoon area for construction and development of a new power plant. The memo says the cost doubled for several reasons, from removal of excess unusable soils to delays due to migratory birds being in the area. Assembly members considered suing the contractor, but were advised that that could cost between $200,000 and $400,000. The Assembly wanted to know how the cost for prep work for a new power station in Muldoon ended up doubling, and whose fault it was, the contractor's or MLNP's. When questioned, MLNP General Manager Jim Posey had few specific answers.
This contractor took absolutely every day of that 100 and some days, whatever the number of days it was, allowed under Title VII provisions to do that. So was that an accounting problem for them in coming up with a number? I can't tell you. But as soon as we had numbers, we started negotiating and coming toward you guys with the problem.
Roger Hickel Contracting was contacted for this story. President Michael Shaw sent an email saying that his company has, quote, acted in good faith with MLNP in constructing the necessary improvements to accommodate the MLNP power plant project in 2014, end quote. In addition to being over budget, the contractor needed a 45-day time extension. Posey is set to retire at the end of the year. He says the full cost of the new plant will be more than $250 million. He says the extra cost for the prep work is already figured into the total budget for the project, and added that he's confident the Assembly will go ahead and pay the bill. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is hosting community engagement events this week. The focus is on being urban in Alaska. Bree Kessler is an assistant professor for health sciences at the Center for Community Engagement and Learning. She says on Saturday, a pop-up museum will appear for a few hours in a downtown neighborhood.
The people in the community will bring pictures or objects or artifacts that are important to them. And it will go into these tents, this museum that we're creating. And anyone who comes can look at the objects and reflect on them and write about them and think about what story they tell about Fairview. And the idea is to create more accurate public memory and public history of what's happening in that neighborhood and what can happen in that neighborhood.
Will you archive the pop-up material somewhere, or is this meant to be temporary?
It's both. So it's meant to be temporary in the sense that it will only be there for a few hours, but the overall plan is that we will scan all the objects, and once we have some funding, that we will archive it on an interactive website. And ideally, this is part of the centennial projects going on around town over the next year, year and a half.
You mentioned having the community bring these pictures and mementos and also to write about them. Are you hoping to have people write things, thoughts about this right there on site and then leave that for part of the archive?
Exactly. So we've created some sheets that have writing prompts on them. And the idea is that these sheets will be in front of the objects or pictures and that community members or visitors that come to the pop-up museum can reflect on the spot about what they're seeing. For instance, if they see a picture, they might write, I have the same picture at home, or I remember seeing this house, this picture of this house when I was little, or things that connect the community together and create, again, a better collective memory of what's happening in the neighborhood.
Are there other pop-up museums planned for other Anchorage neighborhoods?
That's the idea, that this is somewhat of a pilot project and that we would work with other community councils and other courses. This was a project of the civic engagement course that I teach at the university through the Center for Community Engagement and Learning. And so next semester, perhaps we would work with another community to organize a pop-up in their neighborhood.
There's also some neighborhood walks being planned this weekend. What neighborhoods are on the walk route?
Most of the walks are going to be taking place downtown, and there's one in Midtown, but they're dreamt up from students in my honors class, and they're Jane Jacobs walks. And so Jane Jacobs was a public space advocate who talked about getting to know your neighbors and walkable cities. And so there's walks that look at different art or boutiques downtown. There's one called the Urban Survivor, and that's going to be in Midtown, looking at REI and survivor skills and a gun shop and thinking about how to be a great urban survivor in Anchorage.
Bree Kessler is with UAA. Links to Engage events are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Sitka has been named one of the most pedestrian-friendly cities in America. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Sitka gets about 86 inches of rain each year, and nearly half the city's incorporated area sits underwater. That's a pair of statistics that, to an outsider, might not suggest a community built for travel by foot. But this year, Sitka became the first city in Alaska to be named a walk-friendly community. The designation comes from the University of North Carolina's Pedestrian and Bicycle Information Center, which created the Walk Friendly Award in 2010 to highlight communities that are making walking a lifestyle. Participants in Sitka's 2012 Health Summit decided to apply for the Walk Friendly designation to assess the city's strengths and weaknesses from a pedestrian's point of view. Charles Bingham heads up the local group Walk Sitka, which applied on behalf of the city.
You have a lot of physical health benefits, fresh air, exercise, heart healthy, you know, that kind of stuff. There's also economic health because people seem to want to be in an area that's more walkable.
The city received a walk-friendly report card, which praised in particular the high percentage of Sitkans who walk to work, more than 11%, according to the Census Bureau. The report also cited Sitka's extensive trail system, slow speed limits downtown, and low number of pedestrians involved in traffic accidents. 44 cities across the U.S. have been declared walk-friendly. Sitka received a bronze-level designation. Seattle is the only city to win a platinum designation, and Juneau is listed as an honorable mention. Bingham says that there are some challenges when trying to compare Sitka with other communities. For instance, though most residents live on just 35 miles of paved road, the city's formal boundaries encompass a much larger and wilder area.
It was kind of interesting. You know, most communities, you're talking a 30 or 40 square mile area. With us, we had to call in and say, hey, the city and borough of Sitka is 4,000 square miles.
That led to some unusual entries in Sitka's application. In a section designed to assess the percentage of city land devoted to open space, the form asks, area of municipality? 4,811 square miles. Area of parkland? 4,800 square miles. And good luck walking most of it. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, and Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.